Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on voters' confidence, concern, and commitment to the president in a tumultuous time.
Truly dishonest people in the media and the fake media. They make up stories. They have no sources in many cases. They say a source says there is no such thing, but they don't report the facts.
The president is apparently already thinking about re-election because his appearance in Phoenix last night had the tenor of a campaign event.
After years of defending other countries' borders, can you believe we fight for other countries? We want to defend their borders. We're finally defending our own borders.
So as the president speaks to voters, we thought it might be valuable to hear what voters are saying back to the president. Public opinion pollsters have been busy over the last few weeks. Marist is out with a new survey about where the president stands in Rust Belt swing states. And Quinnipiac recently asked Americans about the economy, Congress, and Trump's temperament. Today, I'm going to draw a few questions from those polls. We'll do our own unscientific polling here. And here's one of the questions that Marist asked. When it comes to delivering on campaign promises so far, do you think Donald Trump is winning or losing on bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S.? So that's a poll. That's a question that the Marist researchers asked. And I'm asking you about where you stand on that. When it comes to delivering on campaign promises, has President Trump, is he winning or losing on bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S.? Here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Reid Galen is with us. He's a Republican strategist and the owner of a political consultancy firm. And he's with us today from Park City, Utah. Hey, Reid, welcome. It's good to have you on the show again.
Hey. Thanks. Good morning.
Wendy Schiller is with us. She's chair of the political science department at Brown University. Have classes started yet, Wendy, at Brown?
A little bit later. Week and a half.
Nice. Well, have you enjoyed your summer? I'll bet that's nice.
It's been busy.
Good to have you. Thanks for doing this. So, Reid, let's start with where the president was last night, because Arizona is a pretty turbulent place right now in GOP politics. And we heard, although President Trump didn't name John McCain and Jeff Flake, he was clearly talking about them last night. And he's also supporting this Kelly Ward, who may run or who is running in the primary against Jeff Flake. What is this more about Trump's animus, his personal animus against Flake, or is it about a larger strategy?
The president hasn't typically been strategic in most of his actions. I think he is a highly tactical guy. And what we've seen, I think, vis-a-vis Senator Flake is that he went after Senator Flake, you know, during the campaign last year. Senator Flake fired back. Senator Flake has since written a book, really, you know, about repudiating the type of politics that the president has been espousing, that I think he was displaying in full its full glory last night. And so I think that what, you know, President Trump does is he doesn't remember a lot, but he certainly remembers those who have he believes slighted him in some very public way.
You know, I want to make sure I heard you right. Did you say the president is a fairly tactical guy?
I think he's tactical because he's not strategic. If we're going to go back to what the definition of strategic is, it's taking the long view to achieve a goal and deciding, okay, we're going to employ certain tactics to get there. The president is highly tactical in that all he ever does is respond to the immediate issue in front of him.
Okay. Wendy, do you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the question for people who support President Trump, who voted for Trump, who want to see real things come from that campaign agenda, getting jobs back, for example, in a lot of economically depressed areas, fixing infrastructure with the which the president has mentioned more lately, securing our borders, for example. If you want him to succeed, you have to ask yourself, why isn't he doing the kinds of things that presidents need to do in our system of government to succeed? So whether he's tactical or strategic, the question is, does he even care about success in fulfilling those campaign promises and working with a Republican-controlled Congress? The GOP technically has never been more powerful. They have all the branches of the federal government. government. They have three quarters, give or take, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of state legislatures and state governorships. They should be on the same page, and he should be leading the way. And that's not happening. And if you're a Republican, you should be asking yourself why.
Well, so, Wendy, does that then come back to what Reid said about the tactics and not the strategy? Because having those kinds of legislative agendas and seeing them through really takes strategic thinking.
Well, it takes thinking beyond yourself. What was so striking about that speech last night, it was all about him. It was all about Trump. It was about defending himself and attacking his perceived enemies and how people aren't supportive of him. And it was all about him. And, you know, I think you're the leader of the United States of America. You're the leader of the free world. Voters who voted for him should be asking him to look beyond himself. So I just don't think he cares. At least at the moment, there's no evidence that he actually cares, that what he does is getting in the way, potentially, of enacting his agenda.
Reid, I wonder what you think of this New York Times story today about how frosty it is between Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and President Trump, and that McConnell, according to the Times, has, quote, privately expressed uncertainty that Mr. Trump will be able to salvage his administration after a series of summer crises. What do you think of that?
I think that it is clearly something that the president could have done something about, should have done something about. You know, I think that both the president and the Republican Congress, both Leader McConnell and Speaker Ryan, look, they needed one another. I think that the Republican leadership on the Hill saw President Trump not necessarily as someone who was their favorite person, but could serve as a vehicle for passing a conservative Republican agenda. I think what they're now realizing is that hope is probably long gone, and it was probably misplaced to begin with.
Why? Why was it misplaced?
Because I think they believed that once he got into office, A, either he would understand the weight of, you know, what the presidency and sitting behind the, you know, the resolute desk in the Oval Office meant, or because they thought that they were somehow going to be able to take, you know, President Trump as essentially a tabula rasa, a blank slate, and say, Mr. President, these are the things that are we want to get done to help you, you know, get reelected, pass a Republican agenda. And I think what they forgot, as your other guest mentioned, is that everything with President Trump begins and ends with him. And I think they misplaced their hope that he could get things done as a leader on a legislative agenda.
So here's the thing I'm curious about from both of you, which is whether we see signs that the president's most loyal voters, many of whom showed up last night in Phoenix, Arizona, are okay with following him away from the traditional Republican Party as he puts more and more distance between himself and the party. Wendy, are they with him on that, or are we about to see a test of that?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the vagaries of our electoral system interacting with what people think in the moment. So, you know, the Republicans went to a more proportional representation system in their nomination system in 2016, and that gave Trump life to go through the primaries and build momentum. So you could win with, you know, 35 to 38% of the Republican Party and get the nomination. The same thing happened now. He's at about 38% approval on a good day. And you got to think to yourself, how do you win another general election like that when you have strong support but among a fairly low percentage of the population? So that's the big question mark for Republicans as they move forward. I mean, it's almost September of 2017. We're starting to look straight ahead into November 2018. What do you do with this information? Do you think, Kerry, that there is a strong base that will vote Republican no matter what? Or do you think, uh-oh, you know, he's going to peel away 35% of the base, but I've got to get the rest of the voters to vote for me on election day in a year if I'm Republican? I think that's a very big dilemma for the Republican Party right now.
Reid, what do you think? Will they follow
him? No, I agree. I mean, I think that what you're seeing first and foremost is there have always been major differences within the Republican coalition on everything from, you know, what the government should do to social issues. And I think what you're seeing now is actually a different cleaving of that conservative coalition, in which you're the nativist, nationalist, you know, angry wing is really rising with President Trump, and the more, you know, thoughtful wing is really having a tough time making the case. As you saw, he dispatched 16 relatively speaking, conventional Republicans last year. And so I think come next year, as Wendy said, I think what we're going to see is whether or not the voters in these districts are going to punish Republicans on the Hill for not getting anything done, or are they going to punish President Trump for, you know, his what we would, I think, call erratic first 7-8 months in office. At that point, 18 months, 2 years in office.
So to some of these poll questions that Marist and other pollsters are asking, back to when it comes to delivering on campaign promises so far, do you think Donald Trump is winning or losing on bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S.? Mark tweets to say, source, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 3-month average private sector job growth under Trump still below what Trump called horrible, Obama's second term average. I mean, Reid, this is where it would seem at some point the rubber meets the road. I mean, this is something that a lot of people in our part of the country wanted to believe that Donald Trump could do something about these manufacturing jobs. And I don't know if it was, you know, the president's arguments on why he was going to be able to turn this around did not seem particularly cogent, but people wanted to believe it. Isn't this where, when you start to see the numbers and you see that there is not much progress, may put him in some trouble?
It is. And I think the issue, you know, for the president, broadly speaking, on all of his messaging is it was all built on anger and resentment. Or not all, but a great deal of it was built on anger and resentment. So for a voter to whom those things appeal, you know, they might be angry and resentful. And, yesterday it could have been President Obama, and today it could be President Trump. If they feel like someone has made them a promise that is now not coming to fruition, they could turn on him. I think also, you know, and this is an issue that we face in many parts of our society and our politics is, you know, politicians are often victims of short-termism. It's all well and good to say I'm going to bring manufacturing back, but from the time that, you know, company A says I'm going to build a manufacturing plant to the time that they actually hire people to work in it could be 2 or 3 years. And so I think that, you know, the idea of, you know, we're going to bring Foxconn, you know, back to Wisconsin, or Carrier's going to bring jobs back, but they don't really. You know, whether or not President Trump believes that's quote unquote fake news, people start to see it because they're not going to work in the morning.
And Wendy, the reason I talked about the argument that the president made about that is he never mentioned that many of these jobs in manufacturing have disappeared because of higher productivity. He made it sound like all these companies took all those jobs overseas, and it's just really a matter of persuading them or forcing them to bring those jobs back. What do you do about higher productivity? There's really probably nothing a president can do, and that's something that we want in the manufacturing sector, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the president and the government, I mean, I think Reid's point is so crucial here. And I think even though we're focusing on Trump and the GOP right now, the Democrats, I think, suffered from this as well in 2016, in particular in some areas of the country, making promises about what the government can do or should do or will do to make your life better and give you more economic opportunity. If you can't follow through or you don't, and the Democrats had a Democratic president who signed NAFTA, and, you know, Obama brought us out of the recession. I think that's a fact that we can all agree on. However, some people were clearly left behind from that recovery. So the Democrats have the same problem. It's a question of government not really delivering. And once you start to lose and peel people away from faith in government, in a democracy, then you give rise, I think, to the other more dangerous elements of what we can see in a democracy when it goes in the wrong direction. So that's where I see the biggest danger, is losing faith with the promises on the economy and then basically transferring that to losing faith on things like freedom of the press, freedom of religion, you know, anti-racism. That's the sort of stuff I think that is getting intertwined by Trump on purpose.
Right.
And I think that's what's so insidious at the moment. And I think it could affect both parties.
Republican strategist Reid Galen is with us, and political scientist Wendy Schiller is with us this morning to take note of some of what President Trump said last night in Phoenix, but to also look at what voters are saying to pollsters. I mean, we hear a lot about what the president is saying to voters. I'm curious, as we look at some of these questions that the survey researchers are asking, what voters are saying back about the president. Here's another question off of the Marist poll, and this got a lot of attention. They asked Americans, do you feel proud or embarrassed by the actions of President Trump? Marist again was in this Rust Belt area, as was Quinnipiac. Marist, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin above 61% on yes. I feel embarrassed by the actions of President Trump. And so tell me this morning, whether you supported President Trump or not, how you would answer that question. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Wendy, how did you, is it, maybe I should ask it this way. What is revealed by a question about that? And I actually think there are probably some voters who think that's an unfair question. What do you, when you see numbers in battleground states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin coming in at above 61% as a yes, what does that tell you?
Well, we have to remember that those battleground states, the margin of victory for Trump was so small in two out of three of them, Wisconsin and Michigan. It was bigger in Pennsylvania. But that's just a small number of people turned the election in those three states. So when I see 61%, you know, I sort of question about the numbers. You know, who are we thinking? Who's answering the phone? You know, are we losing the people who are really big Trump supporters, for example? Do they not even answer the polling phone anymore or an internet poll? So that's the big question about polling. Are we actually getting that realm of voter that really is very loyal to the president? I think everybody wants the president to be proud of the president. I mean, whatever party you are, you want to be proud of the president of the United States. And I think he sometimes gives us reason to be proud. I think his speech on Monday was presidential, and it was laid out a very clear idea about Afghanistan, similar to what President Obama did. But nonetheless, it was presidential. So if Trump could just not step on his own message, I think those numbers would improve for him over time.
Reed, what would you say to that?
I think that's probably true. I think, you know, it's funny that, you know, so many of President Trump's, you know, most loyal supporters, you know, believe in the greatness of America. But, you know, in whose eyes, you know, are we the greatest nation on the face of the earth, which I tend to believe. And, you know, but if are we talking about how each other as Americans feel or as the rest of the world feels? If you don't care about the rest of the world or what they think about us, then why is it so important about whether or not we're the greatest nation in you know, on the planet? So, I mean, it's just it's a very interesting thing. And if you don't care about the rest of the world, then you probably don't care whether or not President Trump's behavior is, you know, quote unquote, embarrassing.
James in Blaine called to say Kerry has everything wrong. I think he's talking about when I was talking about manufacturing. Presidents don't create jobs. Yes, James, I agree with that. They say they can. They can make a climate conducive for jobs. I think, James adds, I think Trump can create that atmosphere. James, what I was saying was the numbers show that increased productivity is a big factor and what has happened with the loss of these manufacturing jobs. But overall, Reed, maybe I should ask you about this. James is saying presidents can have a lot to do in creating a climate that's conducive to adding jobs. Is that true, and how do they do that?
Sure, I think they absolutely can. One is, I think, first and foremost, providing a stable platform for the country, both domestically and internationally. I think, secondly, working with Congress, as I think both parties would have liked to have done over the, you know, the last, I don't know, decade or so, to create, you know, a more conducive regulatory and tax scheme in this country that allows larger companies to theoretically hire and, you know, smaller mid-sized companies to either get off the ground initially or expand their businesses by not having to, you know, either compete with outside sources, you know, on a free trade issue or contend with, you know, a burdensome regulatory structure, which costs them money and therefore doesn't allow them to grow their business and therefore hire more people. I think those are the places where government, you know, has the most opportunity. I think also if you're going to talk about, you know, the massive infrastructure upgrades this country needs, that is a place where government can directly contribute to job creation because now you're, you know, you're employing construction firms, architecture firms, engineering firms, based on the money that the government is willing to spend.
So that's interesting, Wendy, because it looks like, I guess Congress is taking up tax reform first, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But this infrastructure plan that the president has high on his agenda does not seem to be at the top of Congress's agenda. Is it because it's expensive? What?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's very expensive. He wants to do a combination of private-public funding and partnerships, and a lot of that would be tax breaks. And we don't know whether those are federal tax breaks or he would ask states and localities and cities to give tax breaks. If you look at the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin, you know, apparently it's $3 billion of tax breaks and subsidies and
all sorts of
incentives for the company. That's a tremendous amount of money, and it's unclear whether all those jobs will come to fruition. We're grappling that in our own little state of Rhode Island. You know, we gave a company a subsidy in terms of bonds, and it blew up on us, and we ended up having to pay $100 million back and didn't create very many jobs. So I think there's a lot of skepticism on that kind of infrastructure plan, and the very conservative wing of the Republican Party will not want to spend the money, and the very liberal wing of the Democratic Party isn't going to want to do it that way. So I think that's one of the big problems with trying to get the infrastructure boats started, plan started. I'm thinking of shipbuilding for boats. But I wonder also about the government's role in creating jobs per se, and rather they should be investing in better education, technical education, vocational education. I keep talking about that. You know, not everybody should go to college right away. What are we going to do for those people who aren't going to go to college and their jobs they used to be able to get don't exist anymore? That's where I think government can make the smart investments that will in turn, I think, increase economic opportunity.
You know, everything we're saying right now, whenever we have this kind of conversation, I remember that for all of the length of our presidential campaigns and 18 million debates, we never seem to get into the nuance of the kinds of things that are really important to understand a complicated issue like the economy and where manufacturing fits into that. Reed, it seems like there isn't, I don't know, a fuller understanding, I guess, of how complicated this is and where government does and doesn't fit into it, which means that politicians get to make a bunch of promises that people want to believe.
Well, sure. I mean, listen, I mean, politicians, I once sat down with a legendary politician in California, and he said, politicians always have to believe things are going to get better, and they always have to tell you things are going to get better, because if they don't believe they're going to get better and they tell you they're not going to get better, then they're not going to be in office for very long. So it's sort of this warped optimism that is not unusual to us and not unusual to, you know, a Republican form of government. I think that, you know, when it comes to manufacturing, you know, what are we going to build, right? We are a service sector economy. We are a very advanced economy, a modern economy. I mean, the idea that somehow, you know, Bethlehem Steel is going to return to Baltimore, Maryland, or U.S. Steel is going to return to Pittsburgh and recreate these giant smelters with thousands of people working in them and, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds of CO2 pumping into the atmosphere is just unrealistic. It's not going to happen. So what exactly does manufacturing in America in the 21st century look like? And I think that is a discussion absolutely worth having. But I think it's also one that for most politicians and most political campaigns, almost impossible to put into a 30-second ad that somebody's going to watch it before the evening news.
And that's a problem. John says on Twitter, corporate America doesn't support manufacturing jobs growing. We're in the age of robotics, and we need high-skilled workers and better-educated Americans. Wendy, that kind of gets to what you were saying. It isn't all college degrees. It's the kind of skills and technical skills that you learn in a lot of different places, including vo-tech education. Is there enough focus on that, do you think?
I don't think there's enough focus on it or attention or funding. However, I do think some local communities, some states, particularly southeastern states, I think South Carolina, for example, and some others, and even Alabama, are trying to partner with local industries and local companies in towns and cities to, you know, recruit in high school, like come to do your studies on our campus and then work. And if you graduate high school, you'll have a job here. So, I mean, those kinds of local connections to me seem to be the most efficient and the most successful because they tailor to specific needs in the community in terms of business. So it may not be that the federal government is the right place to look, but certainly the Secretary of Education could be talking about this and encouraging localities and states to do it. So government can show that it does something. I think that's our big, you know, if we go 2 years and we haven't done anything at the federal level, I mean, literally not done anything, I think that becomes a massive problem for everybody in Congress, actually, in 2018.
Yeah, back to this question that Marist asked Americans as they went out on a survey recently. Do you feel proud or embarrassed of by the actions of President Trump? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I want to hear from you. Wherever you were on Election Day and wherever you are today, as a supporter of President Trump's, as an independent who maybe you thought, roll the dice, let's see what an outsider can do as a Democrat. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR, and to Jim in St. Paul. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I wish there were a third option. I'm repulsed by President Trump, and I'm sort of surprised that people talk about his Afghanistan speech as being very presidential when it came immediately on the heels of his bone-chilling racist press conference at his apartment building in New York. How can a simple teleprompted speech erase all of the racist things that he said? It's just we're caught in some sort of abusive relationship with this man. I'm sickened by him.
Reed, I hear Jim on the cycle of this, the constant. Mm-hmm. Well, on this day, he actually did what a president should. But on this day, he was deeply disappointing and frightening. This just feels like such a volatile, exhausting cycle watching this day to day. How's it feel to you?
I agree completely. And I think that I don't know whether or not it's unbelievable or it's disappointing or whatever it is, that the idea that the leader of the free world is able to read a speech off a teleprompter and somehow that makes him presidential, I think is concerning to say the least and frightening to say the most. If you want me to, I can read a speech off a teleprompter. But if I'm going to go off and say crazy things on Twitter or go off half-cocked at a press conference, as the caller noted, then that doesn't really change your standing. It just creates, as I think you've said, one more cycle through the tumble dry system that we're all going through here, where every day we just don't know what we're going to expect. But I think we should say that none of this should be unexpected anymore. We should expect the unexpected on a daily basis.
Yeah, Wendy, I think about, and, you know, I'm getting sucked into the cable news analysis, too, where, you know, every little statement and every day it's parsed for what it all means in the larger picture. But it does feel like just as Americans kind of stand up and say, okay, there he was behaving the way we think a president should, then there's two steps backwards, and I don't care whether you supported him or not, there's a lot of Americans who cringe around this stuff with Charlottesville and some of the stuff that he said last night in Phoenix. What overall, psychologically, what do you think this is about for Americans?
Well, I mean, I think when I look at this and I think to myself, well, we can certainly take that tack, and I appreciate the caller's concern that we can't sort of forget about Trump's, you know, absolutely awful, you know, unacceptable response to the events in Charlottesville. But we have a president of the United States, and I don't see him getting impeached or removed from office forcibly in the near future. I don't think the Republicans in the House are going to impeach him, no matter what he does. You know, maybe the Mueller investigation yields something that's so bad that he resigns. But generally, this is the president of the United States. And for people who oppose him or resist him or want the government to work, if you simply dismiss Trump voters and you simply say, he's awful, how can you probably support him? And that's
right.
The end of the conversation.
It's not enough.
You will not make progress. Nothing
exactly.
will happen, and things will stay really, really bad. So the way to try to persuade people who supported Donald Trump that maybe he's not doing such a good job is to discuss with them the ways in which he's not doing a good job. But when he does do something that's remotely acceptable as president, you have to say, okay, he did okay. So that's my tack, because I don't want to shut the door to having conversations with people who think that, you know, he's a good president or that he has capacity to be a good president.
Agreed.
Because either he does or he doesn't. But at the moment, he is the president of the United States, and we have to kind of grapple with that on a day-to-day basis. And so that's why I take the position that I do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. To Rolando in St. Paul, sounds like you had an interesting experience on your vacation, Rolando. I'm glad you called.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, we just got back this week from Quebec City, Canada.
Great place.
Yeah, it was a fantastic vacation. But my family and I were there, and we were approached on several occasions about our sentiments about the political climate. And of course, President Trump, and both of us are not Trump supporters. My wife and I are not Trump supporters, and we made that readily clear to whoever we were talking to. But an interesting conversation with the hotel staff, same sort of topic, and they asked us, you know, what we thought of Trump, and we said, well, quite frankly, we're fairly embarrassed of many of his actions, and we didn't support him. And he said, that's really funny, because every single American that comes to the hotel I talk to says that they didn't vote for him and they're embarrassed. I guess his supporters don't travel. So that harkens back to a few of your comments. The comments of the commentators are saying that who cares what Trump does if, you know, we don't care what the world thinks of us. So,
right.
But yeah, that was our experience in Quebec City. And Jen, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, really good to have your call. Reid, I really hear what Wendy said. No matter whether you supported his agenda or his ideas or who he is personally, we all as Americans want the country to succeed. And this volatility, this is why I said, I think this is so psychologically exhausting, because it feels like we're on the precipice of yet more serious trouble. And it's hard to look through the fog and say, but I can see success on the other side. This uncertainty is really exhausting.
It absolutely is. And I think that, anytime we deal with uncertainty in our own lives, in our personal lives, whether or not that is an economic uncertainty, can I pay for my health insurance? Can I pay for my kid to go to college? Can I pay my rent? Right. That is an incredibly stressful thing. Right. You wake up every morning and it weighs on you both mentally, and it has physical manifestations. And I think what we're seeing now is this sort of writ large issue that we're dealing with, which is you never know what the next day is going to be. And I think for, you know, Democrats in this country, you know, and if I were a Democrat, I would understand this. Many of them have not gotten over the fact that President Trump was elected in the first place.
Exactly.
Right? So they're still holding on to that. And for, you know, let's say a half of Republicans like myself, you're sort of like, wow, okay, this is not I've been a lifelong Republican, grew up in Republican politics. This is not what to me it means to be a Republican. And then you've got that last, let's say, 25 to 35% of the country who's like, I'm so angry and so mad. This is what I feel like every day. Hey, the rest of you, welcome to the party.
Is that how you feel too, Wendy? I mean, you're not a lifelong Republican. I don't know what you are, actually. But do you feel like this has upset everything you, as a political scientist, you think you understood about politics?
Yes. I've been following politics since I was a kid, and worked in politics, and taught it, and live and breathe it. And you think, what is going on with, you know, the system? But then I remember from my reading of the founders, Alexander Hamilton has a pretty long quote in a letter to George Washington that says, "Watch out, because this system could elect a guy just like Trump." The description is really just like Trump. And he basically says we could elect a demagogue who's insecure and who wants to abuse and bash the press and do bad things and incite, you know, the wrong elements of society. So we've set up a system we hope works, but the system allows for the election of someone like this. And it took a very long time for that to happen. But I think we're there, where that loophole has been, you know, he found a loophole. Somebody said, you know, he found a kink in the armor of the GOP, got the nomination and got the presidency. So we have to rally around the other principles of this democracy and the other institutions of the democracy and try to figure a way to push back on what could be a worst case scenario.
You two were really great. Thank you so much. Reid, Wendy, I really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Gary.